From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, nearing the deadline for an Iran nuclear deal. Aid agencies express alarm at the rapidly deteriorating situation in Yemen. The WHO appealing for millions of dollars to prop up healthcare in Syria.
As Syria enters fifth year of a conflict, situation is deteriorating.
And a South African comic has a chance to change U.S. perspectives. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Negotiations on curbing Iran's nuclear program entered their final hours today before a self-imposed midnight deadline, with teams from Iran and a group of six world powers trying to resolve 18 months of talks on the outline of a comprehensive agreement. VOA correspondent Al Pessin is in Lausanne, Switzerland, where the talks are being held.
We're in the final hours here, heading towards the deadline, and there's lots of chatter, but I wouldn't say there's anything major. We've had relatively optimistic statements from both the Chinese and Russian foreign ministers who are involved in the talks, but they always caveat it by saying if things continue the way they are or if nothing changes. So there's no guarantee of an agreement. There was an Associated Press report that said officials were drafting a joint statement and a list of points that the negotiators had agreed on. But later there was a Reuters story quoting an official as saying, yes, we're doing that, but we're also preparing statements in case the talks don't work out. So everybody's trying to read the tea leaves and jumping on every little detail. But the fact is that we don't know what's going on behind the scenes. Even the negotiators, I'm convinced, do not know for sure if they're going to get an agreement. If they do get an agreement, we don't know what form it will take. Will it be a written agreement? Will it be a joint statement? Will it be separate but similar statements? There's just no specific requirement at this stage because this is only an interim step. They're supposed to agree on the broad outlines of the agreement. The political decisions are supposed to have been met and the major elements are supposed to be in line, and then they're going to take three more months to write the detailed agreement, and of course that will be a very difficult process as well. So this is an important juncture, but we don't know what's going to happen, and this is not the end of the process in any case.
Do we know what the stumbling blocks are?
Well, we think we know what the stumbling blocks are. I mean, based on various statements here and there, one thing from the Iranian side, they want sanctions relieved more quickly and more definitively than the other negotiators would like. And on the other side, the negotiators want more transparency. They want Iran to ship its uranium, enriched uranium, out of the country. They want some of its facilities repurposed. They want intrusive inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency to ensure that Iran is complying. And they want limits on Iran's development of more sophisticated nuclear technology, at least for several years. So it's very complicated, very technical on the nuclear side as well as on the sanctions side. We have an idea what the sticking points are, but we don't know exactly. And you know, the negotiators are very fond of saying nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. And what that means is that even if they have more or less agreed on some points, if they run into a problem on other points, they may go back to those previous points and say, well, if we give a little more on that, will you give us a little more on this? So everything is in play. It's a very complex three-dimensional puzzle, and we just don't know what's going to happen by or around midnight tonight.
Correspondent Al Pessin reporting from Lausanne, Switzerland. United Nations and international aid agencies are expressing alarm at the rapidly deteriorating human rights and humanitarian situation in Yemen. The agencies are calling on the warring parties to protect civilians and allow desperately needed medical and other aid to reach the victims. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Airstrikes by the Saudi-led coalition of Middle Eastern forces are taking a heavy toll on Yemen's civilian population. Coalition bombings Monday reportedly were the most intense since the operation began several days ago. One site under fire was the Al-Mazra camp for internally displaced people in Harad in the north of Yemen. One of the agencies, the International Organization for Migration, has 400 staff members in Yemen, many of whom were at the camp Monday. IOM spokesman Joel Millman says 40 people were killed and 200 wounded.
We're told that our staff spent the whole night hunkered down on bombing raids. Internet and phone links are difficult, but they're out today doing what they can in hospitals, restoring water systems. And we've been reached by the governments of Sri Lanka, Sudan, Ethiopia, and several others to begin operations to help evacuate some of their personnel in the country.
Many Arab League nations have joined Saudi Arabia in its efforts to defeat the Iran-backed Houthi rebels and return Yemen's president, Abdurrabu Mansour Hadi, to power. UNHCR spokesman William Spindler tells VOA his agency has registered about 250,000 refugees in Yemen, mostly Somalis, but Ethiopians, Iraqis, and other nationalities as well. He says previous fighting displaced about 340,000 people in Yemen.
The latest information we have is that there have been some movements of people fleeing Yemen for Somalia and Djibouti. We don't know how many of these people are Yemenis. There might be among them some Somali refugees returning to Somalia because the situation in Yemen is so dire. The numbers so far are fairly small, but we are preparing for a larger influx should it occur. We are preparing a transit center in Djibouti. And we're also doing making provisions in Somalia.
The International Committee of the Red Cross is urgently appealing to the warring factions to allow delivery of supplies needed to treat casualties from a week of deadly clashes and airstrikes. In the meantime, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zayd Raad Al Hussein, says the killing of so many innocent civilians is unacceptable and condemns all attacks on hospitals and other medical facilities, noting they are protected under international law. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For months, members of the Arab League have been calling for a joint military force to quell the violence engulfing the region. Now that member states have largely agreed, analysts say having the force materialize and preparing it to fight complex modern conflicts may be an insurmountable challenge. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from our Middle East Bureau in Cairo.
Arab heads of states and foreign ministers mostly now agree that an international force of Arab fighters must and will be formed to secure the region. This is Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi at the recent Arab League summit. He promises that military leaders will form a committee to figure out how to assemble an Arab League military force. He does not say exactly who will be in charge or where the force will go, but presumably Libya, Yemen, Iraq, and Syria currently top the list. Not all Arab League representatives agree. Iraqi Foreign Minister Ibrahim Jaafari is against intervention. He says intervention could make the conflicts worse and points out the elephant in the room. Many Arab countries are deeply divided, either internally or externally or both, with Sunni countries and groups generally allying with Saudi Arabia, and Shia countries and groups allying with Iran. With complex tribal and political divisions adding to the chaos, one regional newspaper calls the proposed unified Arab force a triple oxymoron. Abdullah El-Ashal, a former deputy foreign minister and ambassador in Egypt, says these divisions could make it impossible for the Arab world to form a military.
Since when the Arabs are united on anything? If they are united in at any moment, tell me.
And if they did unite enough to form a military, he says conflicting alliances could escalate the fighting. For example, in Yemen, the Iranian-backed Houthis are fighting the Saudi-backed government. Intervention in Yemen, says Ashal, would be tantamount to war with Iran.
What is going to do with the force? To do what? To fight Iran? They will smash them all. Iran is very strong militarily.
But international forces are desperately needed to counter the threat of the so-called Islamic State militant group, adds political analyst Hisham Kassab. And the United States, NATO, and the United Nations are increasingly disinterested in direct Middle East intervention. As a result, he says, the Arab world has no choice but to act.
It's not an option. A force has to be created with some minimal support from the United States and Europe. nobody at this point who is directly threatened can afford to say, none of my business, or I don't want my people killed.
He says the Arab League might not be the best organization to spearhead such a force, as it does not have a long history of actually getting things done. And the current plan will be hindered by the refusal of some countries to participate, along with the lack of military capacity of others. Also, Egypt's massive army is likely to be a key player in any joint Arab force, he says. But the Egyptian army is designed to fight wars with other armies, not militant groups.
The powerful army that will be at the core of it is the Egyptian army. But I don't think that they're ready to shift from an army that is capable of confrontation with another state, i.e. Israel, and turn into a counter-terrorism military.
If the Egyptian army did make the shift, he says, it could jeopardize the balance of power in the Middle East. On the other hand, he adds, alliances in the Middle East are also shifting, and while groups and nations may be divided, the people are largely united against the Islamic State. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Cairo.
The World Health Organization is appealing for $124 million at the International Humanitarian Pledging Conference for Syria in Kuwait. Tarek Kriyasharevich spoke with us from Kuwait about the WHO's recent mission to Syria to assess conditions there.
I'm just coming back from a couple of weeks spent inside Syria. Last week, we went, for example, to Aleppo, a city in the northern part of the country that was very badly affected by this crisis. As soon as we arrived to the city, we have been called to visit local hospital where dozens of injured people were rushed that morning after several mortars landed in the central part of Aleppo. So we could really see the high price civilians are paying in this conflict, but we also saw dedication of health workers, doctors, nurses, and other staff that is really doing their best under difficult circumstances to help those who were injured in that particular instance, but also patients in general.
What is the overall situation in the nation?
When it comes to health situation in Syria, as Syria enters fifth year of a conflict, situation is deteriorating. There are more health centers, more hospitals being put out of function, more ambulances being put out of function. Immunization coverage is getting lower. There is a problem with the access to clean water. All this causes number of emerging diseases. People who have chronic diseases also have problems of getting the medicines they need. So basically, there is a combination of elements making that the health situation is getting worse, and we really need to continue to do what we do so we can provide help, provide basic health services to the population. And this is why we really count on this conference in Kuwait to try to raise some funds so we can continue to provide treatments and supporting health system and all health providers in all parts of Syria as we did so far.
It's a very dangerous place, Syria. Are you concerned about your World Health workers?
Well, we are definitely concerned. And I was just telling you about this incident in Aleppo that we were able to witness. One of the victims was accidentally a doctor who worked in this same hospital. It's just a person who happened to be at the right place, at the wrong place at the wrong time. So basically, health workers are equally paying the price. Lack of access to health services is not only for that when patients cannot come to health services that are still functioning, but also health workers who cannot access their working place. So they are the real heroes of this of this conflict, but also paying a high price.
Have you found that the health workers are targets of the violence deliberately?
Well, there were instances where health facilities were deliberately targeted, were used as a military facilities as well. We know that in Syria, around 45% of health workers have left the country, leaving some places with shortage of health workers. So again, what we are trying from our side, from the World Health Organization, we organize frequent trainings for health workers, trying to equip them to deal with a number of different medical conditions that people may have so they can do their job at best. We also really try to support health facilities with equipment, with medical supplies they need. We also try really to help with financial support to vaccination campaigns that we are doing by paying per diems to vaccination teams. So really our work is helping health workers in Syria, and we hope that donor countries will show their solidarity with us and by that with the health workers inside the country.
Tarek Kriyasharovich with the World Health Organization speaking with us from Kuwait.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
German authorities say the co-pilot suspected of deliberately crashing a plane into the French Alps had suicidal tendencies. The March 24th crash of German Wings Airbus A320 en route to Dusseldorf from Barcelona killed all 150 people on board. Prosecutors say 27-year-old Andreas Lubitz suffered bouts of depression and anxiety and was receiving psychotherapy while earning his pilot's license. Parent company Lufthansa certified him to fly in 2013. A motive behind the crash remains elusive. Investigators say an evaluation of the recovered cockpit voice recorder alleges Lubitz locked the pilot out of the cockpit before slamming the plane into a French mountainside. That has prompted some airlines to mandate the presence of at least two people in the cockpit at all times. The website airsafe.com has provided aviation security information to the flying public as well as the airline industry since 1996. Founder Todd Curtis told VOA's Victor Beatty requiring two people in the cockpit will help eliminate a repeat of last week's tragedy.
That scenario won't exist, but certainly if there is someone in the cockpit who might be, let's say, a flight attendant, who may not be as sophisticated with trying to wrestle control from the aircraft, if the person wanted to lock the cabin door and either try and subdue the second person or start manipulating the controls, whatever their opinion may have been about it, someone who is not a pilot may not be in a position to counteract someone who has an intent to wreck the aircraft. It will be very, very beneficial to have a second person in the unlikely event of some sort of medical emergency happening. Heart attack, stroke, where the person is incapacitated, it may accidentally or in their delusion lock the cabin door and maybe pass out. That scenario, having two people in the cockpit, that's a good idea. But will it prevent what happened last week? In my opinion, if someone intends to crash the airplane, they can do so whether or not there's someone else in the cockpit or not. Should something be done in the wake of what happened in France? I think public sentiment is overwhelming that something should be done now, not necessarily saying it should be a permanent change, but something should be done to address this issue and as soon as possible. So I believe the public's fear has been allayed greatly by the industry pretty much universally taking steps in that direction.
Do you anticipate any changes by domestic and international aviation authorities and by the air carriers themselves with regard to who actually sits in the cockpit?
I suspect there may be changes, but they won't be done in the short term. Any changes like that would imply there would have to be a change in not only the screening of candidates and the training of candidates. There would have to be, in my opinion, also changes in the laws and the regulations that are relevant when it comes to who can and cannot fly.
Do you see an irony post 9/11 in sealing the cockpit from the rest of the passengers that the pilot was locked out and found it impossible to get in before the plane crashed, and what could be done about that?
Any system, any set of procedures, any protective barrier that one erects in order to prevent a certain kind of risk usually means that there's a trade-off. Reduction of one risk may mean an increase in other risk or the creation of brand new risk. Well, that's one thing. On the other hand, I can say this. The issue of pilots taking command of an aircraft and deliberately crashing it or trying to crash it existed before the rules of 9/11. In fact, in a brief bit of research I did after the events in France, I looked for events since 1980 where an airline pilot is either suspected to have or was proven to have deliberately crashed an aircraft. And there were seven cases, including France, where that was true. And an eighth case, which happened to be a FedEx aircraft in the U.S. in 1994, where an off-duty pilot tried to commandeer an aircraft from the three on-duty pilots, and the three pilots were barely able to fight this man off and land the airplane safely. So whether or not you have these protective barriers for 9/11, the same underlying problem exists. There are a small number of pilots out there who, for whatever reason, may one day decide to put the entire aircraft and everyone else at risk who was on that aircraft. The big question is, how do you find out this risk before it manifests itself? And how do you deal with it once it happens in the sky?
Curtis says, given the tens of thousands of aircraft operating worldwide, any changes to the cockpit will likely take years to implement unless aviation authorities mandate immediate alterations. He says air travel remains among the safest modes of transportation, with only a handful of fatal events each year. However, in the case of the German Wings crash and the disappearance of Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 in March of last year, he says the public's perception of safety is impacted by the amount of media attention given to each event. Curtis says the deliberate crash of Mozambican Airlines flight TM470 in November 2013 by the pilot received scant coverage. South Africa's comedy community is beside itself after the announcement that South African comedian Trevor Noah will take over from Jon Stewart as host of the most popular political satire program in the United States, The Daily Show. In South Africa, the mixed-race comedian is loved for his edgy jibes about race and language, but will he get lost in translation in the U.S.? From Johannesburg, VOA's Anita Powell talks with some of the nation's comedy elite.
The comedian known as Deep Fried Man, real name Daniel Friedman, was in poor shape to speak to VOA News the morning after the epic announcement that South African comic Trevor Noah will take the helm of the popular satirical American news program, The Daily Show. That's because, Friedman croaked, he and fellow cast members of Late Night News with Louis Hogola, South Africa's version of The Daily Show, had an impromptu blowout party to celebrate Monday night.
Everyone basically went crazy. It was an amazing atmosphere because all the people I work with have sort of either less or more degrees of separation from Trevor, and most of the team have worked with him before, and some of the team know him really well. It was very distracting because we were still in the middle of shooting an episode, and I have no idea how we managed to finish the episode.
The show's content producer, Karabo Ledija, also a bit worse for wear after the celebratory bash, said her show would not exist if not for The Daily Show. She said she is excited about the serious possibilities of Noah's new job.
For Trevor in that spot, that amazing, spectacular spot, it just means a better opportunity of us to be just normal, you know, like everybody else around the world. And I think that for me, is the powerful thing about this.
Noah has often touched on this subject in his comedy, lambasting Western views of Africa as impoverished and behind the times. Friedman says comedy can be a serious business. In troubled societies, it can be a gentle way of shining a light on ugly truths. That, he says, is Noah's specialty. But he worries about how far more politically correct American audiences can be pushed.
Trevor is already in person, a lot more than on Twitter, very able to discuss difficult concepts in a non-offensive way. And he's so charming that he can pretty much go anywhere. But I think his biggest challenge is going to be the fact that I think the U.S. has a bit of a lower threshold for controversial comedy than we do.
Ledija agrees that Noah has room to explore sticky issues of race, but says she's not sure how he will approach it.
Man, I have no idea. But America has its own race issues, and maybe that's good. But they're discussed, I think. You know, I think America has their own race issues to talk about a lot. So maybe it's not such a bad thing.
Whatever happens, it's going to be interesting. Stay tuned, world. Here comes Trevor Noah. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey. In Washington,